5, 4, 3, 2, 1, 0, ignition, liftoff.
Hey everybody, I'm Brian Clapp, VP of Content and Engaged Learning at WorkInSports.com, and this is the Work in Sports Podcast. When I was growing up in the Boston area, I used to get a kick out of the regional ads with the local sports stars. Dwight Evans would be reading an ad for the local Chevy dealer, and it would be hilariously terrible. You can picture these guys showing up, never having read the script, and then trying to read a cue card cold that's being held by some poor intern above the camera. The local sports star would have their eyes clearly above the camera, so you knew that they were reading off a cue card off camera, right? So that you could tell when you're watching it that they're not really looking at the camera, they're reading something off camera. And they'd be reading it at such a poor level, and there was always some terrible dad joke at the end. It would be like, "Hello everyone, I am Red Sox right fielder Dwight Evans, and you should head down to Bob Chevrolet in Chicopee and check on deals they've got for a brand new 1985 Chevy Blazer. We've got all different shades of red, like my socks." And then they'd smile some toothy grin and still not be looking at the camera. You knew this was like the 20th take, and finally the producer was just like, "Oh, F it. That's good enough. It's a wrap. Let's be done with this. This is awful. This is the worst day of my life." And these ads, they cracked me up. I wish they still happen as often as they used to when I was a kid, when I was 10. I mean, seriously, 10-year-old fifth grade kid, all of us would be imitating these ads in gym class, like making fun of our local heroes for reading with less aptitude and personality than we did. Like, we joke around that, "Oh, Mr. Doe would have criticized him for his enunciation on that one, that's for sure." You know, like, we'd be joking that way. This is a big deal, but for the athletes, this is a big deal back in the day. They made really good money back then, but nothing like what the players do today. Salaries have far outpaced inflation, and there's more money in sports than ever. So the borderline Hall of Fame players don't need to really peddle the local furniture store to get a free couch and an extra $5K. It was a lot of work for them and for the brands, and the work didn't always result well. Like, it didn't work. More often than not, they resulted in a crappy advertisement that likely didn't help the business or the player's brand. Sponsorship between athletes and brands, it wasn't working that well back then. But things have changed, thankfully for the better, although I really miss those old ads, and I'm going to do a search afterwards and see if they're on YouTube, because there's got to be some out there. Anyway, so how have things changed? Well, social is a huge part of it. Today's athletes grew up with it. So think about this. The old athletes from the 80s and 90s, when I was growing up in the industry, they didn't have a lot of TV experience. They weren't doing spots on TV very often. So this is all very new to them. Well, athletes today grew up with social. They're comfortable on the platforms. They're comfortable talking to into their phone and looking at a camera. They have their own brands. They've shared their own voice directly to their followers. They're a lot more articulate. They're just more confident in this space. So it's better. Right? That's one thing. The other thing is, we have more and more brands that are thinking deeper and targeting better. They're thinking to themselves, "Wait, I make a vegan snack bar, and I'm sure there's an athlete out there who is vegan. Maybe that's the way we should partner up." So they're aligning better. And this idea of hyper-targeting in alignment with a specific athlete makes all the sense in the world, because the athlete will now speak to the product with more enthusiasm and expertise than just some rando talking about a Chevy Blazer in red when they actually drive a Porsche. This extra level of targeting, this emphasis on social, this idea to connect brands and athletes, that sparks something deep within today's guest. Ishveen Anand is the founder and CEO of Open Sponsorship, a platform that has created a smarter, simpler approach to sponsorship marketing, allowing brands to connect with 5,000 athletes, engage with their target audience, increase their return on investment, and generate great content. Everyone is winning. The athletes are building their personal brand. The brands themselves are actually getting a return on their investment and seeing their product promoted the right way. And she's helping to bridge this gap between those two stakeholders. Ishveen was also named Forbes 30 Under 30 in 2015 and to the Inc. Top 100 Female Founders list in 2019. She is as impressive as they come. So without further ado, here's Ishveen Anand, straight from her office in New York City, and you'll understand why I mentioned that in a few minutes when you hear fire alarms and police sirens in the background. Here's Ishveen. Hi, Ashreen. How are you doing today?
Good. Thanks, Brian. How are you?
I'm doing really well, and I'm so excited to talk to you about your business, Open Sponsorship, and so many of the things that you've started doing in your career. Before we get into your business and all the things you're doing to kind of change the world of sponsorship in sports, I want to get back to you and your understanding your motivation a little bit better. You attended Oxford, you graduated with a degree in economics and management, and your career just took off from there. Within about 5 years, you were the CEO of a company after graduating, and then you launched your business, Open Sponsorship. What was your mindset during this time? Did you kind of always have this goal of someday I'm going to start my own thing, or did it kind of happen more organically where you were just seeing the right opportunity to go after something new and went for it?
Yeah, definitely the latter. I think as many entrepreneurs are, you're pretty impulsive people who think, oh, there's a problem, let me go fix it. I think if you really thought through things and you had a plan, then entrepreneurship is not the best thing for you because there's so many things that go wrong once you start. So I always just like followed my heart. I was very fortunate that, you know, my parents supported the decision of just, you know, do what makes you happy as long as you work hard and work smart and everything else. Hence, you know, the Oxford, I worked in consulting, then I moved into sports. And so, you know, really it was just a case when I saw a problem, I would try and fix it. And if no one was fixing that problem, then I'd started my own company to do it.
See, I think that's really cool. And this is the interesting thing about entrepreneurship is that so often somebody has experienced a certain side of the industry, whatever it may be, sees something that isn't working quite as efficiently or sees some sort of a market inefficiency that they feel they can do something about and they jump into it. So it sounds like that's kind of what happened for you because you started out in the business development sponsorship side. Did you experience something that said, all right, there's a better way to do this?
Yeah, absolutely. So, yeah, fell in love with sponsorship sales, but really I was very interested, you know, my background, I grew up in England, I was working in India, but thanks to my job there, I was traveling to West Indies and Bangladesh, Sri Lanka, all over the world. And I was very confused as to why there wasn't more cross-border partnerships or use of rights cross-border. And so that was the problem I was solving at that point, which was, you know, why am I not doing deals across the diaspora when media rights are very global, but sponsorship wasn't? And then through that, that's when I was like, whoa, like, why is there no technology to do this the way Airbnb has brought that, like, efficiency, or, you know, it's possible to book a house on the other side of the world thanks to this platform called Airbnb. Why can't you book a sponsorship asset on the other side of the world thanks to a platform? And so it was always a reaction to something that I thought, well, why is there not a way to do this?
See, I think that's fascinating, is that you can almost see some other side of some other completely different industry and say, wait a second, if they can make it super efficient to with Airbnb, why doesn't this apply to my world currently? And I think not enough people probably think that way, that a lot of the problems that we have in our marketplace can be solved through the ingenuity that might already be out there in a way, but you can repurpose to fit your own world. Is that what the initial start of it was, like following a little bit of this model and putting your own twist on it?
Oh, 100%. I think, you know, my friends were all on, like, I was married, but a lot of my friends, single friends, were on dating sites. And so that fascinated me. Like, how do these matchings happen? And then real estate was really interesting to me where, you know, you've got the traditional market with estate agents, and then you've got Zillow, and how do they all play? So I always say, like, recruitment, real estate, dating, they were the forerunners of, like, marketplaces changing an industry. And I've taken a lot of those learnings for our platform.
Okay, cool. I want to get into all that. But before we get too far away from your background a little bit, because you're already getting me, I'm getting excited about all the different things that Open Sponsorship does. I want to dial back for a quick second, though, and just explain that you come from an economics background. That's what you studied in school. And initially, that sounds like kind of a disconnect for the sports world, or a disconnect for even the sales world. And yet, I've seen more and more high-level executives in the sports industry, not just on the tech side, but also on the team side, who have an economics background. Is that a focus that's changing in the sports industry? And specific to you, why do you think the economics background has kind of set you down this path of entrepreneurship and helped you in that journey?
Yeah, it's a great question. Obviously, I studied in England, and so I could speak to that level of education a bit differently, but I'd say the main thing is that when you're at school level, when, you know, between those years of 18 to 21, 22, you're not really learning anything that you're going to apply for the rest of your life. Maybe if you're in medicine and law, but a lot of the degrees, like if you're learning about marketing today, by the time you come out of school or a year into your first job, everything's changed. And so I think what's really important for those years is learning how to think, how to evaluate problems, how to solve challenges, how to use hard and soft skills to come together. And I think economics, you know, you get that background of like being able to build a spreadsheet, finance, think analytically, but there's also a big part of economics, which is being creative or applying maths to real world problems and understanding that, you know, supply and demand, there's like this nice curve of like supply goes up, demand goes down, demand goes up, supply goes down. But at the end of the day, there are other factors and what causes that, tariffs or whatever else. And so I think the beauty of these well-rounded degrees, like I have friends who did geography and history and became investment bankers. And I think the biggest thing is like, is your degree, is your school teaching you how to think and solve problems as opposed to giving you factual information that is very niche and probably isn't relevant to 99% of jobs.
See, that's fascinating to me because I interviewed Adam Frazier, who's the CEO of Laureus Sports for Good, just a couple weeks ago, maybe a month ago. And he, from England as well, spoke almost the exact same way and that the education system is very different there. He actually studied classics while he was in college.
Yeah.
And is now in a completely different role. Whereas here in the States, so often we think in a very linear fashion of getting the exact education you need, learning these exacting skills in a very narrow focus. So now that you are running your own company, how do you see that exhibit when you're hiring staff or you're bringing people in? Are you looking for people that are more well-rounded, or I know you're getting bombarded mostly with people here in the States who have a very different educational background?
Yeah, it's a very good question. I think I don't pay that much attention to the degree at
okay.
all. I think the school is important. And then I'm looking for experiences that are well-rounded. So I think, I was interviewing actually someone recently who had studied sports management but was working in marketing software technology. And so that's interesting to me because it shows, okay, great, like you were interested in sports, but you moved away, you've got another experience, and then you're coming back. And then the main thing for us is we, no offense to most colleges, but they're not teaching what we're doing right now, right?
True.
So we don't do traditional sponsorship sales. When we talk about athlete marketing, we're talking about digital social boosting, even what we think changes day to day. And so if you come in and say, well, I've learned this in sports management, I'm going to really question that. So it's more for me, I'm glad you have an interest in sports. I think most people do, even if they don't take a sports management degree. But it's more so like, have you got a well-rounded number of experiences that we can lean on that adds value to our company?
See, that's really fascinating. And I agree with it 100%. I think that's something you're seeing more is people being open to, you don't have to have just a sports management degree, or you don't have to have just a specific sort of background. It's the overall picture of you and the soft skills and everything else that can propel you to the front. So I want to get into the sponsorship side because you do something very interesting within this realm of sponsorship sales. But initially, you started out in a more traditional sponsorship sales role. And I interviewed Dan Rossetti, who is a sports recruiter, and he's a very prominent one, very good at it. And I asked him over a year ago, what's the hardest role for you to fill? And he said, like, without a batting an eye, he was like, sponsorship sales. And so I ask you, somebody with this background and somebody that's disrupting the sponsorship market, why is that? Why does it seem like it's such a hard area to find talented people to fit? Is there something specific to this side of the industry that is just complex for people, or is there just a unique skill set? What do you think?
Yeah, it's such an interesting question. I think sponsorship, I think sales generally is a very difficult role to fill because good salespeople are in very high demand and they're probably pretty comfortable making a lot of money where they're doing well. It's kind of against their ethos to like, why would I move and go somewhere else where I have to learn a new process where I'm doing well and I'm making good money? So I think sales generally is very difficult. I think sponsorship sales is a very involved sale. And it's also, I mean, this is the kind of why I sometimes say we're like that anti-sponsorship. It's a long sales cycle. And so, you know, when you're talking about traditional like sponsorship for a team or for a league, I mean, you're talking like 6-7 figure deals that could take 6 months, if not a year, to negotiate. So it's a pretty risky hire. It's not easy to track quick results. You know, in software sales, it's like, cool, the ramp is 3 months. After 3 months, you know if they're going to be good or not. If not, you let them loose, and the base can be quite low. Whereas in sponsorship sales, it's like, all right, I'm going to have to pay them well. It can't be very heavily commissioned only, because there's a chance they might not do a deal for a year and they're just cultivating. There's a lot of trust that goes into the fact that they can cultivate these relationships and it will pay off in an 18-month horizon. So I think it's just a really difficult role to even evaluate people for. And then that means that you get the same few players who everyone is sought after because they've proven, where usually in other industries you can bring in a lot of new people, but the risk is so high because it's so like lack of measurable off the bat that I think you stay away from that. And then you end up just hiring like 10-year veterans. But how many of them are there? And so I think that's probably why it's so difficult to hire. I mean, I do think the skill set is specialized in all of that, but I think it's the other stuff more than just the skill set.
Yeah, it's fascinating. So I've never worked in the specifically in the sales side or sponsorship side of the industry, but when I was the news director at Fox Sports Northwest, we were approached to give the naming rights to the what was then the Seattle Football Stadium, because it was under new construction. And I remember their sponsorship sales team pitching to us, and it was like they put in weeks and weeks of effort to put together this pitch, and it was a $20 million deal. And it was all these great levels to it, and yet we weren't able to do it. So all that effort went for nothing on their part. So I can understand what you're saying is that there's a long cycle to try to close these massive deals and make them happen. And that's not always easy to attract people to, even if there is a huge payoff in the end. I do want to pivot now to your specific company, because I think it's fascinating. I want to hear it from your words. So open sponsorship, explain the product, but please also... I love that you're in traffic right now, but but it's New York, right? I mean, this is to be expected, but are you in New York? No, it's fine. It's totally fine. Are you kidding me? Are you in New York right now?
Yeah, I am. Okay. And actually that's through like two levels of windows as well.
That's New York. Exactly. Makes perfect sense now. So let's talk about open sponsorship. Explain the product for us, but then also help explain and give the full picture of how this helps solve the inherent problems and difficulties with coordinating these sponsorship deals.
Yeah, absolutely. In fact, I think it ties in really nicely to your last question, which I'd say the other part of hiring that sponsorship salesperson and why it's so difficult, or what the industry trends towards, is people with relationships. And so how many people have a relationship, and therefore you always have to go for them because they're the ones who can get you in the door. And going back to that example of where we mirror ourselves, dating, recruitment, real estate, back in the day, let's say even 5 years ago, if you wanted to sell your house, you'd go for the best broker on the market that was the most sought after, who had like the biggest little black book, right, of contacts. Oh, yeah. If you wanted to get headhunted, you'd do the same thing. Maybe if you were dating, you'd always go to your friend and be like, oh, you're the sociable one. You've hooked up everyone else. Hook me up. And so there was always this idea about like relationships and like a connector. And then these really disruptive technology companies came along and said, No. No one needs to sit in the middle. Let's connect both sides based on merit, based on reach, right? Whether it's recruitment, you go online and you say LinkedIn, like here's my skill set. Let me find the best person, or let me find the best job suited for me. And it doesn't matter if I've never met them before. I can get that. And so that's really what we thought with sponsorship, which is, if let's say the Dallas Mavericks have an amazing sponsorship sales stud who knows everyone, but Houston Rockets down the road haven't been able to hire that person yet. does that mean that the Dallas Mavericks should have all the sponsors and Houston Rockets shouldn't have any, even though like the Rockets are performing better and have the better team? Why does relationships matter? Same thing with athletes. Like if you're repped by the best agent, does that mean that you should make 10x the next guy who's not repped by the best agent, but could be a better performer, a better personality? And we just took that approach, which is, let's just give access to every single athlete, team, and event, but we're really focused on athletes at the moment. That's 80% of our business. So let's just focus on, you know, all athletes and let merit be the, you know, fit, authenticity, merit, data drive the decision, as opposed to, do you have a relationship? And obviously for the brand, it works the same way, where, you know, the Nikes and Adidas says, you know, I really hope that they use us because we've got all this great technology and we could do so much for them. But at the moment, our sweet spot is that brand who probably hasn't done that much in sports. Maybe they've done one or two deals. They want to scale it. Maybe they did one or two deals and had a bad experience. And we're saying to them, listen, like, put up this idea of this campaign. You know, I'm a vegan brand and I'm looking for athletes who are vegan, and let our universe of 6,000 plus athletes apply to you and say, hey, pick me. I am, you know, I am Danny Green and I am vegetarian. I did it. You know, I went vegan last year and here's my price point. And so our whole thing is like, let's make relationships based on authenticity and data as opposed to based on who we know.
So I am also a vegetarian athlete, but I don't think I work up to the scale that you're looking for. but I, so, okay, this is where I get hung up in the whole entrepreneurial world, because I am fascinated by it. And I admire so much of what you're able to establish. But you have this idea based on your own experience. It clearly fills a need, one that you have professional experience with. But to make it work from the idea phase to the actual execution phase, you need athletes, you need brands, you need organizations, you need rights holders, you need others to buy into what you are doing and providing. So you have, like you said, over 6,000 athletes on your platform now, but you didn't when the idea first came up. How did you get to that point to make your product viable out there in the marketplace so you could attract brands and say, hey, we have X number of athletes who are looking to make some deals here, come here. Like, how did you get to that point?
Yeah, a lot of hard work. One, listening to people. Two, what we first started onboarding athletes. And in fact, we didn't know it was going to be athletes. We were onboarding teams, anyone who wanted to sign up and do sponsorship. And, you know, my background had been, I'd been selling like shirts, front deals. So athletes was like a little bit of my business, but not a huge amount. But we really listened to the market and we, you know, influencer marketing became massive. People like Kim Kardashian were making millions. Even small micro influencers were making money. And we thought, wow, this could be interesting for the athlete world. And so, you know, I'd say it's constantly, people talk about pivoting, and that sounds like a dirty word in a startup. And it's not about pivoting, but it's about adjusting to what people are saying to you at that point. Always, you always have that bigger mission, right? We'll always say we want to be the Airbnb of sponsorship, but let's first attack like one little thing at a time and, you know, tick it off and prove that we can do it, keep growing and get to the next thing. So I'd say it was just really like, let's take a little bit, let's keep growing, let's listen to the market. We started with really small brands. We had a much lower price point. At first we were free, then we had a membership, it was low, and we kept increasing over the time. We increased the size of brand we work with. So just constant iteration to get us to where we are today.
Is it a lot easier now to go to the athletes with a proof of concept and say, look, this is working. You can see it in action. Here are examples of what we've done. There's proof of concept. Is it much easier now to get the athletes or any of the other brands to come on board and see the value right away?
Yeah, it's definitely easier, but then, you know, there's also more options. So, you know, at the beginning, there was like less people doing what we're doing, or there's also, you know, I'd say it's always different challenges. So for us now, it's like we're charging a lot more because we realized we needed to. So when I talk to brands at the moment, it's like, okay, it's a much harder sell because we're more expensive. I mean, not that crazy expensive, but we're a bit more expensive. So I'd say you're constantly, there's always a battle, but yeah, it's definitely, I mean, proof of concept is there. We've done 4,000 deals. We've worked, done deals for as large as like a Todd Gurley, Danny Green, Draymond Green, all the way down to like super niche lacrosse, field hockey, OCR. So I think all the proof of concept's there, but it's just a different challenge that you're facing.
So what you mentioned it earlier, and I kind of thought of it the same way, is that I see open sponsorship and it almost feels like a dating website, right? Where you match needs and wants locally, regionally, you know, you're in my area, whatever it may be. You're finding a connection that fits your budget and objectives, even though in dating sites, they don't talk about budget very often, but you get the idea. Is it oversimplifying to think of open sponsorship as a matchmaker in the sports business world in a way of like somebody, an athlete comes on and says, here's who I am. And the brands are able to find them that way? Is that kind of your model a bit?
Yeah, no, I'd say it's a very good description, and it's not an oversimplification at all.
So I read this line. It was on your LinkedIn page, and it really stood out to me. It's about open sponsorship. You wrote, "We are democratizing sponsorship by making it accessible, efficient, and data-driven." So I love this. It's to the point. It's easy to understand. But I want to hear that data-driven part a little bit more. Not every organization has a huge marketing budget or even have a sports sponsorship side of their organization. They can't bring in the Tom Brady's or the LeBron James or whatever to sell their brand. And they're probably saying to you, like, I need to see an ROI. I need to see a return on investment here and know that if we make this leap, it's going to work for us. How are you able to provide data to all the different companies to prove that the type of sponsorship deals you're able to arrange are going to work for them?
Yeah, it's a great question. We do a lot with data and tech and integration. So we integrate into our brands Google Analytics. And we will actually give every athlete as part of their deal a tracking link, like a unique UTM tracking link, so we can track exactly what that athlete drove in terms of like website traffic, in terms of conversions to the brand site. Some brands, what they care about is engagement and brand uplift. So we do a lot of work with social media where we're showing, okay, comments, likes, how did that perform? So there's a lot that we are building and constantly building on the ROI piece to try and show what happened in that deal. And then we actually use that data again to help recommendations. So, you know, if you're a CPG brand that identifies almost like as a lifestyle brand, great. Who else have we worked with who's similar to you, who has the same kind of budgets with you, and who's seen success? So we're constantly using our own data, like any good site should. We're using our own data to help make the experience better for others. And so it's not just a post research like thing we put on your desk. We're actually using it to help you drive good decisions.
So you are a CEO and founder of a growing company, and you have been for a couple of years now. What are some of the main things you've learned being the CEO, and how to allocate your time so that you're not just putting out fires all day long, but you're able to think bigger about the strategy and where the company's going as a whole? What are some of the things you've taken away in your years as the CEO and founder?
Yeah, there's so many learnings. I do think you end up putting out a lot of like fires and doing a lot of reactionary things. I'd say it's balancing the day-to-day needs of the business as well as having an eye on the bigger plan. If you go one way, it's detrimental, right? So if you only look at the bigger picture and forget the day-to-day, you'll never get there, right? Because you won't manage your team well, or you won't do the little things that make a difference. But if you do it the other way, then you could go off plan as well. So I think trying to balance the two is really difficult, but very, very important. I'd say every entrepreneur at the beginning has to basically like do everything and be the sole person and, do everything better than anyone else. And then there comes a time when, you know, I could work all Saturday and all Sunday, but I am one person and, you know, our team's 12 people big. Like, doesn't it make more sense to try and help my team be more efficient during the hours of like 9 till 6 Monday and Friday, as opposed to just think that I can do everything myself? And so really understanding that at some point the dynamic shifts between how much can you do and what's the point of working 24 hours when what you want to do is empower the team to work harder, work smarter.
I think that's brilliant advice. I mean, I remember in my own career coming up initially being more of that individual contributor who had to just get everything done, and then transitioning to a phase where I'm more now in a leadership role and I'm thinking 6 months ahead. But at the same time, you also have to manage that day to day and get everything on track. So I want to pivot back for a second to the sponsorship side. And I hope that you're not actually on fire right now, because it does sound like you have some sirens in the background. It's not near you.
New York.
Yeah, I know. You just got to roll with it. That's the whole fun of these podcasts, is that we just roll with it. I'm not editing any of this. It's going to stay in. Can any brand benefit from having an athlete endorser, or are there certain brands it makes more sense for? Like, is sports kind of ubiquitous in the marketplace and anybody can benefit from it, or does it really only make sense for a certain amount of market?
Yeah. I mean, I would say definitely yes. So if you break out brands to B2B, B2C, what's interesting is, so B2C is usually our target segment. You know, we like products that athletes would genuinely use or interested in or could get behind. But traditionally for sponsorship, B2B has been a big driver. So you think like insurance or oil and gas or finance or any of these big behemoth industries, B2B has always been a driver. And so the reason being is because they need someone else to help tell their story. So we once did a deal with Lamar Miller and Texaco. And, you know, Texaco was trying to show something about like strength and resistance. And, you know, every brand has, I suppose, characteristics that they're trying to bring to life, whether it's Deloitte or, you know, an accounting firm or a legal firm. And so using personalities to help bring those to life is really key. So that's on the B2B side. It always makes sense. On the B2C side, a lot of people always think of athletes and say, okay, well, you know, it must be the Nikes, the vitamins, or the sports endemic products. But actually, one of the things that we really like is showing athletes outside of just being on the court. And athletes also love that. You know, there's obviously been such a big movement recently, like we're more than just an athlete. You know, we have a family, we have a voice, we could be LGBT, we suffer from depression and whatever else. And so I think riding that wave, there's not a product on the market that an athlete couldn't connect to, whether it's for their parents, their kids, their wife, if they're female, their husband, for themselves. And so we're really big champions of like, challenge us. If you can't see the fit, we absolutely love doing that. We often have brands say, all right, we're a Wi-Fi router. How could we use you guys? And we're like, well, athletes have Wi-Fi and they probably use more than anyone else because they're gaming all the time when they're not on the court. Like, let's do a story around that. And so our whole thing is like, challenge us and we'll help you find the storyline even if you can't think of it.
See, I love that, because I've interviewed athletes my entire career and I feel like they're yearning to be known for something outside, or be at least recognized for something outside of their skill in their particular arena. They want to be respected for their mind, their thoughts, their activities outside, their foundation, who they are as a person and their family. And I think it's great that you're presenting it that way. Let's use this podcast as a quick case study. If we're looking for a naming sponsor for our podcast, to date, we've been thinking of it like, oh, well, we should go out to sports connected firms. But you're kind of saying, in a way, I should approach this differently and maybe think about other organizations we might connect with, and that there's a way to tell a story. Is that true in sponsorship, that it's really about how you can tell the story of connection?
Yeah. To give you like a quick few tidbits there, we say one is, think about line items that you already pay for, and then see if you could like either knock those off through a sponsorship deal, or at least you've got a story. So let's say this, as part of your podcast, I bet you always do like a water break, right? Now, or you drink water while you're, you know, it's probably important to stay hydrated so that your voice comes out good. So maybe like, think about what's in your office right now. So approaching a water company and be like, hey, podcasters always need to stay hydrated. I actually like to drink Gatorade because it gives me like a little pickup as well. Or maybe I'm a Monster Energy guy. So like, there's a story. If you look around, I bet you've got like things on your desk, which are like pens. You're always writing notes. Let's go to a pen company and be like, hey, like podcasters you think podcasts and pens are like not synonymous. Let's create a cool content piece around like how podcasters use pens throughout and blah, blah, blah. And so I think I like, that's where I see like that authenticity. Like, what are you already including in your kind of day-to-day, your life? So when I'm talking to teams, you know, some of the best sponsorships is when they sit down and I think I saw a deal with a WNBA team in Salesforce. And it makes so much sense, right? Like, these teams have tons of employees. They all use CRMs for ticket sales, for sponsorship sales. Why would they not do a deal with Salesforce? And now Salesforce can create some really good content and a story out of like how a WNBA team is powered by Salesforce.
I love it. I love that you use the word authenticity a lot too. That's one of my favorite words out there in the English language, I believe, is that there's often a lack of it and it becomes so obvious. But when you can really dig into your authentic self and what your brand represents and how it's all connected to your story and how you want to present it, and it's genuine and from you, whether that's from the athlete side or the brand side, it's like the everything becomes clearer and better. And I like that you're emphasizing that as a part of the platform, is making these authentic connections that makes sense in a match, right?
Yes, absolutely. And I'd also say, when it's truly authentic, what genuinely happens is that the price that the athlete commands is lower because they want to do the deal. And then everyone's a winner because the athlete is getting paid and is getting a sponsorship deal they probably wouldn't, but is maybe charging less to be aligned with a great brand. And then the brand is getting a better deal and feels like it because they're actually doing something with someone that they, you know, who genuinely believes in their company.
See, that's fascinating. I wouldn't have thought that, but it makes total sense. If this is something you're passionate about as an athlete, you're not demanding top dollar. You actually want to also make this work for the other company. That's really interesting. So tell me this, are most of the deals, and I want to wrap this up because I don't want to take away too much of your day, but just so much of this conversation is so fascinating to me. Do most of your deals, as far as a sponsorship goes, do they get activated a lot through social media channels? Or what are they? I mean, it's not the same where it's like, back when I was first coming up in the industry, everything was TV, you know, like, oh, they do a local TV ad, or they do a regional TV ad, or whatever it may be. But it seems now more of these deals are happening through social channels and reaching a younger audience. Is that what you seem to be true? Is that most of the deals you're creating are executing and activating out there in social?
100%. Yeah, it's where marketing dollars are going. It's super easy to put up there. It doesn't require a huge TV spend on the back end. Very easy to test what works. It's where a lot of the athletes' fans are, as opposed to TV, where goodness knows who you're targeting. So many levels of why it makes sense. But yeah, a big bulk of our deals are on and Instagram, mainly.
Yeah, it makes total sense. It's easy to get the data from. You can see the impact of it right away. You can turn it around rather quickly. It doesn't have to be a huge production to make a TV ad. It just makes all the sense in the world. And so I'm sure that's opened up your world a lot. Let's finish up with this. You've clearly changed the dynamic in sponsorship sales and created an open marketplace for profitable connections to be made. So I ask you, and put on your future hat for a little bit, where do we go from here? Where does this side of the business grow and change in the future? Because as an entrepreneur, I know that you're always thinking about where the next market inefficiency is or where we're going next, and you can't afford to get too in the weeds. You have to be looking ahead. So tell me, what do you see coming in the future in these type of marketplaces?
You mean outside of what we're doing, like, if other people were thinking about marketplace.
Wherever you want to take it. What do you think's happening new in sports sponsorship, or what do you see as the next horizons? Whatever is jiving with you, what are you feeling?
Yeah, I say so we personally are excited about college. I think that'll be big for us, really big for us. I think there used to be such a big difference between media and sponsorship. So it's like, you know, you went to ESPN to buy media and then you'd go to the team to buy sponsorship or the league. I see like those titles of like media buying and sponsorship buying and whatever else are kind of merging. So it'll be interesting to see, like, podcasts are a great example. Are they media dollars or are they marketing dollars? Probably media, but marketing by it too. So I think there'll be something to do with that and how media and marketing come together. Generally, other things, I think there's so much excitement. There's so many exciting places. Like, I think B2B, I love B2B. I think businesses need to evolve over time. It does take time. Like, for us, we have to be in the market. We have to show that it's were proven to get people to say yes to us. So I think B2B will continue its huge growth of like technological and disruption.
Ishveen, I can't thank you enough for this. I mean, I'm just so fascinated by all that you've accomplished and everything that's going on there. I think open sponsorship should start sponsoring the Work in Sports podcast. No, I'm just kidding. I'm not kidding, but that's fine. But no, I love what you're accomplishing. And I think it's just so great to talk to you and understand how you've, like I keep saying, disrupted this marketplace and just changed the way that things are working. And just by twisting it and changing the perspective on it, I think it teaches so many people in the audience what's available to them as well, because so much of our audience tends to be younger, establishing who they want to be, and to realize this is something they can do too, is that they can see an opportunity and go for it without fear, or with some fear probably too, but to go after it still, I think, is really inspiring. So thank you for coming on today.
Awesome. Thank you so much for having me.
I hope you could hear my admiration throughout that interview. I've personally gone the entrepreneur route, and it is not easy. I failed at it. Ishveen is thriving. I'm more than impressed. I'm inspired listening to her. Thanks for listening, everyone. Two more great interviews lined up for next week. We're crushing January with all of your help. So please keep downloading, sharing, and giving us positive reviews wherever you listen. It really helps, and I appreciate it. All right, everybody, get back to work.